So yeah, my talk today is actually going to touch on many of the themes that have been discussed. I'm pretty much going to give you an overview of this new paradigm we're developing for the membrane is some kind of electromechanical structure. Hopefully it'll make some discussion here. So just to kind of start off, summarize a lot of things, a lot of speakers have already covered, the membrane of cells is has a fundamental structure of a two-dimensional bilayer. Evans and Skalik in the 1970s and 80s, put together the fundamental mechanical properties that behaves as a two-dimensional and compressive material. The very large elastic area modulus, but a very small but finite resistance of bending, meaning that it's a soft structure, thermal fluctuations are very pronounced in membranes, and has no resistance to shear deformation. Now, despite a lot of work that's been done, a lot of important questions remain unanswered, particularly with regard to the effect of applied electric fields and how the mechanical properties gets influenced by perhaps surface charges or applied potentials, okay? And these are the two questions on which we're going to talk about today, both in the context of pure membranes and also in the context of cells. Okay, so why is it we think the membrane might have these electromechanical properties? Remember your thermodynamics, everything is pretty much connected, so that if you were to, many materials, if you were to apply an electric field to those materials, you could develop strain or stress, and that phenomenon is known as electromechanical coupling. Quartz is a very prime example of a material that exhibits this type of electromechanical effects, which are known as piezoelectricity. So the way you capture these, and now most people are familiar just with stress and strain and straight elasticity theory, where you have a stress related to the strain and a tensor of elastic tensor coefficients characterizing the elasticity of the material. In the case of electromechanical properties, that tensor gets modified by electromechanical coupling coefficients multiplied by the magnitude of the electric field. Likewise, in electromechanical materials, you're also going to, when you apply the field, you can have a displacement that occurs. And so now your displacement current in most dielectric type of materials is given by the relationship between D in the electric field, with the permittivity of the material being the coupling coefficient. And again, if you have electromechanical coefficients, you can then have strain actually inducing electric displacement in the material, and there's a piezoelectric tensor for these coupling coefficients too. Okay, so there's reasons to think that because the membrane does in fact have charged materials, it might demonstrate this type of electromechanical effects. So to give you a little history of what piezoelectricity is, it was first observed here in 1874. German physicist Braun, who had metal sulfide crystals, and when he applied pressure, he noticed electric currents. Okay. Later, the brothers Curie had quartz, and they started piling weights on top of quartz, and they could also record a current, and they named this effect piezoelectricity after the Greek word piezo in the press. Okay. So in the late turn of the century, it was very interesting, but it was kind of a useless discovery. But of course, in the early 1920s, there were these popular hobby kits, these little detector crystals made of cast whiskers. You might find these in some kind of old stores. But of course, piezoelectricity later became the basis of sonar and frequency control devices and selective filters. Okay, so now, do membranes exhibit anything like this, okay? So I'm gonna give you my personal history here, where we were doing tether experiments when I was a PhD student and noticed something that was equivalent to pounding quartz with a hammer. Then as a postdoc, I went into electromechanical coupling in these very particular cells in the cochlea. We developed a converse flexoelectric model for how this cell operates, which is kind of a special type of piezoelectricity. And then I returned to more recently the tethers, where we've been able to, in very controlled experiments, get a handle on the electromechanical coupling coefficients of the membrane. Okay, so let's start with the tethers. This is a technique whereby you would apply a glass, have a bead, attach it to a cell, and then pull on the bead with a point force. In this case, it's been done with an optical trap out of a hair cell out of the cochlea. But when you do this experiment, what you notice is the membrane kind of forms in tubular structure on a kind of nanometer scale, okay? And the force that is hold this tether, it's gonna be experimental variable that you measure along with the radius and length of the tether. And this force is gonna reflect the tension in the membrane, and if you're working with a cell, it's gonna reflect adhesion to the cytoskeleton. And most importantly, it'll reflect the bending stiffness, because what you're doing here is you're taking the membrane to a very highly curved structure. And so this has been a very accurate method to measure the bending rigidity of vesicles and red blood cells. My advisor, Rick Wall, pioneered a lot of these experiments. And it appears to be, so far, the only way that we've been able to get out what's known as a non-local bending rigidity of the membrane. So how do we get at the bending stiffness? These are experiments that I was doing, where we have a giant neodymium metal vesicle, and we yank it into a micropipette under controlled tension. And we're doing these under a horizontal microscope, where the force on a bead would be the force of gravity. And we could adjust the pressure in the pipette and notice a tether stopping at different lengths, okay? And we could also measure the force accurately. So through some straightforward mechanics, what you would predict is that the force required to form the tether is inversely related to the radius of the structure, with the coefficient being the bending stiffness. In this experiment, we can accurately estimate the radius by the material that actually would leave the pipette when we change the tension and go into the tether. And that would enable us to estimate the bending stiffness fairly accurately. So we got it was around 10 to minus 19 joules, okay? But there's another layer of complexity to the tether experiment, which is that when you form the structure, it's highly curved, you actually expand the lipids in the outer leaflet of the membrane, and you compress the leaflets on the inner leaflet of the membrane, okay? So what this energetic contribution is known as is the non-local bending energy, okay? And it arises from the fact that when you just in general ever bend a membrane, the two leaflets of the bilayer constrain the main in contact. So what we have here is an exaggeration. As a result of that constraint, the lipids on the inner leaflet have to pack more tightly, and the lipids on the outer leaflet have to expand. So that gives you this contribution to the energy known as the non-local or area difference elasticity, rising from this differential expansion compression in the bilayer, okay? Now, in the tether experiment, what was found was that the length that you could hold it at depended on the membrane tension. And so you could use that data between the tension and length to extract the non-local bending coefficient here. What theory predicted, it was about 3 times Kc, and our measurements pretty much kind of supported that. Okay, so now to get the kind of antidotes of electromechanics, I talked with David Needham the other day. He was reminding me some stuff when he was visiting Rick Waugh's lab, which is that when they were turning the TV monitor, the length of this tether would actually kind of start changing. I had a Ben Franklin experience when I was at one point going to change the pressure in the pipette reservoir, which was a metal, and I got static discharge. I hit a tether at about 700 microns. I got static discharge, and then the tether snapped back instantaneously. I'd never seen a tether return to a vesicle surface that quick within less of a second. I showed that to my advisor, and his comment was, "Well, that's interesting." End of discussion. So at the time, we didn't quite have the ability to kind of interpret. So at around this point, I was ready to graduate, and I was bored with membranes. You know, I started out in physics, and so I thought cells were too complicated. But after 5-6 years of working just on the components membranes, I wanted to get moved to something more complex. So I took a postdoc in auditory physiology, working on the mechanics of how hair cells of the cochlea operate. So I'm going to give you a little background on this here for the next 10 minutes, because this kind of sets up a paradigm of electromechanical coupling in cell membranes, okay? So the way the ear works, a theory was done by Helmholtz, who actually, and when you get a degree in physics, they tell you he was a great physicist. He was actually trained as a medical doctor, and he was a professor of physiology. And my former chairman at Johns Hopkins considered him the first kind of bioengineer, actually. So Helmholtz has his book, which is a classic in music theory now, too, where he puts together physics, acoustics, and physiology. And he was the first to kind of postulate that the way the ear had to work was that he had different parts sitting by vibration, by different pitches, that are kind of receiving the sensations of the tones. Okay, so what those parts are, just give me 1 minute of the anatomy here from high school. We get the sound waves propagating down the ear canal, putting the eardrum into motion. Then the bones of the middle ear start vibrating and acting as impedance transformers, just take the sound vibrations in air and set a pattern of fluid mechanical vibrations in the snail-shaped cochlea, which if you would cut in kind of cross length, you would see it's composed of three kind of fluid-filled compartments. And then wedged in between two of these compartments is an array of very delicate, specialized tissue known as organ cordae, which contains two types of hair cells here. And so the fundamental paradigm here is that and the organ cordae is riding on top of a basement membrane known as the basal membrane. So if you were to model this simply, how is it that vibrations get translated within the cochlea? You would talk about the kind of impedance of this structure, and we could collapse this whole organ of cordae into some idealized membrane. And the cochlea is coiled, so in principle, the impedance of the structure could change as I kind of go around up the length of the cochlea, which I'm saying, imagine I would lay it out and call that distance X. So the impedance here will depend on the stiffness, the mass, and the kind of viscous resistance. So like any kind of, if you would plug your equation of wave motion here, you would predict that the resonant frequency would depend on the square root of the stiffness and mass. And the way the cochlea operates here actually is that the stiffness of this basal membrane changes along the length, and that's how you encode certain sounds and frequencies, such that you encode high frequencies at the base and low frequencies at the apex. Okay, so what actually is going down is a traveling wave of vibrations. This was figured out by von Bakasy in the 1960s, who received the only Nobel Prize ever awarded in physiology and medicine for hearing research. Now, however, these passive traveling waves are not the whole story because of the sharp tuning that's observed in the cochlea. So if I imagine I have a purely passive mechanical system, and I would driving with a periodic force, and I could measure the response. I could do a Fourier transform of my response and see that my response as a function of frequency will be fairly broad. In the 1970s, people were making mechanical models of the cochlea, noticing that the tuning of the cochlea was much sharper. The vibrations were much sharper than could be accounted for by passive mechanical models. And it was a physicist, Thomas Gold, actually, who in the late 40s predicted that what you needed to have was some kind of active mechanical energy source in the cochlea to improve the frequency selectivity by feeding energy back into the basal membrane, okay? So this active energy source, though, gives you instabilities which manifest themselves as otoacoustic emissions. So those of you who have normal hearing, if you would take a microphone, put it up here, you could hear sound coming out of the ear. And that's an indication that the cochlea is working. Now, people thought this guy actually was nuts for proposing this because the idea that a sensor organ was producing what it's supposed to be sensing was really counterintuitive. It'd be like the eye making light. But the ear, in fact, does make now sounds as a result of an active mechanical energy source. So where is that active mechanical energy source? One clue in organ cordae was that these outer hair cells, which exist in these three rows, have innervation known as efferent innervation, meaning that they're receiving input from the brainstem, okay? Poised to act as a kind of feedback loop, okay? Now, it was later discovered that when you change the potential on the outer hair cell membrane, if you put the outer hair cell electric field, it would change its length, okay? So this phenomena is known as outer hair cell electromotility. It's a kind of whole cell piezoelectricity, electromechanical transduction, very responsible for the sensitivity, frequency, selectivity of mammalian hearing. So as we age, these cells start to die, and this is why we start to get age-induced hearing loss. A lot of drugs will also knock these cells. But now this electromotility phenomenon is very sensitive to salicylate and also concentrations of intracellular anions, which gives us a clue that something in terms of membrane surface potentials here might be a little involved. I usually show electromotility. Let's do this here for a minute since it's the end of the day. So, hope the sound is working. So this is an electrode that's an isolated cell, and they're playing the tune of a well-known song here, Rock Around the Clock. So we call this the dancing hair cell. So we change the potential, the length starts changing. piezoelectric material. Okay, good. So, I always use this to wake up my students in the middle of lectures. 50-minute lecture, and it's about move forward. Okay, so what they have, there's also a lot of evidence I don't have time to go into, which argues that this electromechanical coupling is completely base in the membrane of the cell. You can digest the cytoskeleton. You still see this phenomenon. Okay, so what are the proposed kind of models, kind of on a phenomenological level, how we might understand this? The first ones that were developed, known as area motor model, piezoelectric model, assuming the membrane was completely flat, and then you had proteins in the membrane that were kind of motor proteins that, when you change the potential, would change the area. Okay, and we call that the kind of area motor model. When I started getting into this field, we were feeling that area changes and acoustic frequencies are not likely to help. Yeah. That's it. Question.
Can you say that again?
Let me come closer. My hair cells don't work too well.
Could you just repeat what you said about the area motor model?
Yeah, just that it's the, I think my voice got low?
Yeah.
It's just that, it's a piezoelectric type of thing. There's a protein in the membrane that changes the surface area, okay? And it's supposed to happen, this phenomenon will happen at acoustic frequencies. So we didn't feel the energetics would quite be right to allow for that. However, because the bending energy of the membrane is so small, you could have nanoscale kind of deformations in the curvature. And that would be known as flexoelectricity, which is a type of coupling between the curvature and the applied field. Okay? But the existence of flexoelectricity in membranes is a little bit controversial to say the least, so we'll be getting into that. Okay, so now in my laboratory, which I call the membrane auditory bioengineering laboratory, we want to understand the mechanism of this electromechanical transduction in membrane, especially by the suppressing protein. So approaches are to use thermodynamics to make models, use micromechanical measurements, optical imaging to see if we can go on the nanoscale, and we're also getting into some electron tomography, which I don't have time to go into. Okay, so now if you would look at this cell under the electron microscope, what you would see is a very elaborate cytoskeletal architecture. Okay, you have an outermost plasma membrane. Then you would see these pillow proteins extending from the membrane to the cytoskeleton. And then you would have actin molecules wound circumferentially, cross-linked by spectrin molecules. Okay? So they get the cytoskeleton kind of fourfold symmetry here. Now there's controversy over whether or not there's in fact the membrane between these pillars is wrinkled. So I went to Timoshenko, who's a great Russian applied mechanician, and he treats the problem of a pressurized cylinder supported by circumferential rings, which in this case would kind of be analogous to the actin. The other thing I should say is the outer hair cell has an internal turbo pressure. It's fairly unique for mammalian cells. So when you blow a cylinder like this up with pressure, what do you predict that you would get kind of wrinkling between the points of attachments? Now, it was interesting that I took Timoshenko's derivation and recast it in kind of membrane formalism, put in the actual value of the turbo pressure of the hair cell, the radius of the cell, estimated the compressibility modulus of the lipid bilayer. We predict we get about 16 nanometer radius of curvature. The electron micrograph seems about 30, so we're not too far off. Of course, I often have to talk to the otolaryngology research community, which I'm not skilled in mechanics, so when I showed them this, they didn't believe me, so I had to get kind of limp analogy that we have this kind of something like the Hindenburg here. We have an interior scaffolding in the cell. We stretch an elastic membrane over it, blow it up with pressure, and then you get wrinkles in between the points where you attach, depending on the kind of nature of the attachments. Okay, so then to build this flexoelectric model, we treat the membrane as a kind of liquid crystal, which is, of course, the intermediate state of matter between a solid crystal like quartz and a liquid like water. So you'll have orientational and not positional order in liquid crystal material. And often the dipoles will be free to kind of rotate when you kind of apply the force. Okay? Of course, in all membranes, the proteins and lipids do possess dipole moments. Okay, so just in liquid crystal materials, the flexoelectric effect is well-established will accept, established and accepted. Of course, there's an electro-optical effect associated with it, which is the way our monitor is working here, rotation of the polarization, okay? So, but this is existing membranes, okay? Now, in Bulgaria, there's a school, liquid crystal physics, and Alexander Petrov has been pushing the idea since the 70s that when you bend a membrane, because of the dipoles of both ends, you should establish some kind of differential kind of surface tension, which would lead you to, a possible jump in the potential, which could then induce kind of a current. Likewise, if I apply a field, I might expect the dipoles to respond in such a way that the curvature will change. Okay, there was a question. Yeah.
Yeah, you said that the molecules are modeled as liquid crystals. What do you think? The molecules are modeled as?
The molecules are modeled as a liquid crystal?
So what is the shape of that?
What is the shape of the molecule?
Yeah.
Oh, that we're not sure. But you're right. The effect will, the magnitude of the effect is very dependent on the exact shape that you have.
Yeah, because the entire physics changes if the molecule is there.
So the entire physics changes when the molecules
change? Have a single reaction that.
Well, the argument Petra, even in a symmetric member with wide shaped molecules, if you bend it, you increase dipole density on one layer in reference to the other layer, kind of like the non-local bending.
Like
that induces a net polarization.
Is it like this shape?
Even if the molecule is cone-shaped, the argument is that in this case, you can get something, okay? When you bend, there's no polar, okay, so you got cone-shaped molecules in a flat membrane. There's no effect. Okay, because you cancel out the polarizations on both sides. If you induce a curvature and hold the molecules in place, then the argument is you will induce a small polarization. We can argue more in detail here. That's a very good point, but the actual magnitude of the coefficient can depend on the shape. Okay, and now proteins, of course, shapes can be very different. And so that's what protein-induced flexoelectricity would think would be much larger. But now, in the pure membrane argument, is that the fluidity of the membrane should counteract this, because if I build up these curvature gradients, they should relax over the surface, okay? And Evan Evans is very strong on this point with me. I like to argue with him when I run into him. One day he got a little heated, and he told me that, absolutely can't get these effects in this kind of membrane. because it's not the way God created the membrane. I see a few people know it, Evan Evans. So he, of course, was my grandfather, my advisor's advisor. So in getting into the stuff, I'm breaking with the family a little bit.
But
I'm getting David on my side.
No, he does talk to God, and God does talk to him, so he's all right.
All right. So, of course, now, don't get depressed by that, because Arthur C. Clarke says that when a distinguished but early scientist states impossible, he's almost certainly right. When he states it's not possible, he's probably wrong. Evans isn't here to defend himself. It's not fair, huh? Okay, so what this flexoelectric effect is this curvature-induced polarization. And it is the primary mode in pneumatic liquid crystal materials, enhanced if they have certain shapes. Very distinguished from the piezoelectric effect in solid crystals, because in the piezoelectric effect, you have to have certain symmetry requirements in the material, such as the strain that the charge displaces in the plane of the material. Okay, so the way you get into bottomless effect is to assume the polarization is equal to a flexoelectric coupling coefficient multiplied by the curvature, okay? And then the converse of this effect is if I hit dipoles in the membrane and I start applying a field, we can start lining up the dipoles in such a way to increase the net polarization vector of the material. And you will register a current along with the deformation. Okay? So Petrov had only developed the linear model of flexoelectricity. One of our contributions was to extend this to the nonlinear regime by invoking the Langevin function, which of course allows the dipoles to rotate freely, which is still a degree of approximation, but essential to captures the essential nonlinearity and emphasizes that what's important here is not the applied field, but the kind of local field seen by the dipole within the membrane. So I'm going to come back to that point a little later. Okay. So coming back to the outer hair cell now, if I had this kind of microarchitecture, and I would apply voltage, regular wave pedal structures, I would predict that you would get this change in the curvature coupled with a change in the kind of length of the attached filament. If I assume this is kind of like a flexoelectric unit, the membrane between the pillars altogether. Okay? So at this point, it's a very phenomenological type of model. Of course, we want to make sure our energies kind of add up, so we don't have Maxwell's demons haunting, so what you can the model, so you can write the bending energy, the membrane, the energy store, and the spectral network. And then we could combine these to get an effective mechanical energy, which I collapse the energy to extend the spectrum with the energy to kind of bend the membrane, an effective bending modulus. What you do then is that run the model as you would in a normal kind of electromechanical coupling material with an electrical enthalpy representation where we form the mechanical energy and then you subtract from that the integral of E times the displacement. We put the nonlinear polarization in there, and then we get new constitutive equations describing the behavior of an electromechanical membrane, namely that the moment resultant will go as this effective bending rigidity times the curvature, and the active component of it will be given by the Langevin function, which is a function of the voltage. And likewise, you'll get an electric displacement, which has a kind of the normal capacitive component contribution of the membrane, and then this active component associated with the bending. So at this point, I figured the model is finished. We have new constitutive equations, and we get new constitutive equations for what you need to do, right? Now people were telling me you need to fit the data. I guess the theoreticians will appreciate that. You know, it's often more important to have beauty in your equations as opposed to have them fit the experiments. But we were actually able to go, we were able to fit this data on how the hair cell changes its length of voltage. A point parameter of the fit was this flexoelectric coefficient, which happened to come out, which came out to be 10 to the minus 19 coulombs, which is what you expect it to be in a liquid crystalline type of material, similar to kind of lipid membrane. So we're kind of happy with that. We were also able to fit the data to the charge displacement that's measured in the membrane when we change the potential. In addition, we were able to explain tension sensitivity. This is the capacitance of the membrane, which is the derivative of the charge with respect to voltage. When you change the pressure in the membrane, this capacitance function kind of shifts. Okay, and we were able to do that by explicitly considering the effects of the internal field, again, in a continuum type of model, where there's a kind of coefficient, the internal field constant relating my external field to my internal field. That coefficient responds to stress, so we can predict kind of changes in the center point of the capacitance as well as the magnitude of the capacitance. Okay, I ran out of slides here, so I'm going to go through this fast so we get to kind of some of the interesting membrane stuff. So we're able to explain this. Okay, so now let's talk about what's going on at the molecular level for about 10 minutes here. So within the membrane of the hair cell, we have these densely packed particles, which everyone was saying, these are the motor protein that change the area when I change the voltage. Okay, so through biochemical mechanisms, people identified these particles as a protein called presin, after the musical tempo, presto, because it acts so fast. So this protein is highly expressed in these cells. It's a member of a transporter family, which is a little bit funny. But when you take this protein, you put it into other cells, they start to move and they have this kind of electromechanical coupling phenomena. We have very little biochemical structural information on this, but if we know we take it, if you take it out of a mouse, you're gonna get a kind of hearing impairment. So it's absolutely essential. And some people believe sufficient because we can transfect it into like an epithelial cell line and see a bit of movement. So it's the people who discovered it at Northwestern say it's going to be the nanoscale actuator of the kind of 21st century for people into bio-nanotechnology. Okay, so one idea how this presin might work is that it kind of forms a network in the membrane. Okay, so some of the things we do at my laboratory are kind of addressing the interaction of question with the membrane and whether it forms this network using recovery after photobleaching and also residence energy transfer to detect how close the proteins are getting the membrane. Okay, so these FRAP experiments test membrane mobility by having the protein transfected into the cell and then imaging it on a microscope, coming in with the laser, killing the fluorescence at time zero, and then monitoring the recovery of fluorescence as the molecules kind of diffuse back into the spot. So what you get out of this is a characteristic recovery time, as well as kind of an MOR fraction, which indicates that you failed to kind of fully recover the fluorescence, and you can calculate the diffusion coefficient for protein membrane. So when we do this with lipids, we get the very fast recovery and kind of full recovery of the intensity, okay? Indicating lipids, of course, are highly mobile in the plane of the membrane. When, on the other hand, when we do this with Preston, we get these kind of large immobile fractions, and then even on a second bleach, the recovery for the protein is a lot smaller. Even on a second bleach, we're still detecting some immobile fraction, which indicates we might have kind of restricted mobility of this protein. We're doing experiments on whether this is due to the two possibilities. One is that the diffusion of the protein is limited because it's confined to a microdomain of lipids. And yet another possibility is that it could have a long C-terminus and it can't get around cytoskeletal fences. Third possibility is that if you associate it together, of course, now you have a bigger molecular complex and more diffusion. So the cholesterol experiments are showing that we use MBCD to deplete the cholesterol, we're getting kind of increased mobility of the protein, indicating domains may be playing a role here in keeping the question networked in the membrane. And then the other possibility, not mutually exclusive, is that you could be getting interactions between these cytoplasmic tails of the question to kind of form this kind of network. To test this, we use this resonance energy transfer technique, which is a very powerful technique for measuring the association of membrane proteins. The idea here is that if you have the Preston molecule and I label it with two fluorophores whose excitation and emission spectrum satisfy certain criteria, then if those molecules are close, and the ones we've chosen here are CFP and YFP, if those molecules are close, when I excite, say, the CFP molecule, the energy can be transferred to the YFP molecule, and I detect emission from the other protein. Okay? So this is due to dipole coupling, and the Dobronsky diagrams. So the efficiency here depends on how much overlap you have between the excitation of the donor and the absorption of the acceptor, quantum yields, and then distance. It's extremely sensitive to distance on the, it goes as basically the distance between the molecules, the efficiency of energy transfer, where it goes as the distance between the molecules to the sixth power. And then it's all scaled by the Forster radius, which is usually 3 to 5 nanometers. So we have a very powerful technique here for looking at associations between proteins on the 1 to 10 nanometer scale. Okay, so this is my student, Jenny Gleason, who's doing this work. And so basically, to make long story short, what we're seeing in here using different kind of correction methods of the fluorescent signal is a clear signal, clear FRET signals indicating when these proteins are transfected in the membranes, they appear to be self-assembling into networks and with restricted mobility. This method here selects for where the signal's lowest, actually. And what we see here is that the signal's lowest in the membrane. So it's actually a good method for delineating the kind of membrane fluorescence signal. Okay, now we back this up with a acceptor photobleach method of FRET, whereby we kill the fluorescence from the acceptor molecule, and then the acceptance from the donor increases because you can no longer get this kind of energy transfer. Using this technique, we monitor different regions of interest of the cell, and again, being very careful about number of controls, which we found these types of measurements, we're confident that we've established threat efficiency much higher than in control regions of the cell. Again, supporting this idea that this Preston motor protein somehow is networking memory. Okay? So, now our efficiency is actually probably an underestimate because we can't control donor acceptor ratios, and the efficiency you get is maximal when you're when you have a high ratio of donors to acceptors. So, okay, so kind of bring this back to the ISO level and what's going on here. We have this nanoscale architecture, curvature of this ISO membrane. Okay. Our FRAP experiments are confirming that we get aggregation of the proteins, okay? Now, there's a number of theories, I guess Jamal introduced one, in which there's this coupling between aggregation of proteins and kind of curvature. So what we, and then McMahon and Gallup treat this in their review also. So what we're working with here is a kind of working hypothesis is that the change in the voltage, in the case of this cell, may in fact be inducing aggregation of the protein, changing the curvature, and that becomes a basis of your flexoelectric effect. And then because I have this kind of regular network structure, which we have to update on a regular picture, the fluidity arguments kind of don't come in. And if we have the right symmetry requirements on this molecule, then this kind of could be a mechanism of electromechanical coupling in cells. Okay, so now I have to, this point we're turning to tethers here, okay? So it's kind of there and back again. And then we got come back to the usual company. How David doesn't mind being Sam Austin, because he had to support Rick, who was Frodo, who had to take the ring of power from him.
One of the younger looking people.
okay, and then I'm Pippin looking to the ball where I'm not supposed to. Electrical effects, okay. So, now through some great collaborations with my colleague at Rice, Bauman and Browdy, who has an optical tweezer, is an expert at biomedical kind of optics, what he's done is he's combined optical tweezers with the voltage clamping such that he can look for the force, how the force on the tether behaves when he changes the holding potential, okay? And so we can now do models of how these proposed forms of electromotility affect the tether conformation and perhaps distinguish him by quote-unquote seeing at the nanoscale. Okay, so what he does it here actually is he comes in with a patch pipette which controls the transmembrane potential, okay? And then he does sinusoidal actually stimulations, changing the potential as a function of time. So what the data reveal, and very, interesting, it's kind of two trends, only one of which we've gotten into the model. One is that your steady state tether force here is very, very highly dependent on your holding potential, okay? So when you're holding around 50 millivolts, okay, holding at minus 120 millivolts here, force is down here around 50 piconeums. When he depolarizes a cell up to 60 millivolts, the force goes up to about 110 picoloops. And then because he's oscillating the potential, he also measures this electrically invoked tether force, which also becomes bigger with depolarization, which is something we don't understand, but we're concentrating on just this change in equilibrium tether force, and I'm surprised that it's kind of that dramatic. But given my Ben Franklin experience, maybe I shouldn't have thought it was quite that dramatic. There might be something about highly curved membranes that really, really enhances the sensitivity to membrane potential, okay? So how do we go about as a first pass understanding this, okay? So we go back to the energy functional, Evans and Waugh have constructed, okay? Whereby the tether force, the energies related to the tether depend on membrane bending, cytoskeletal adhesion, the work to pull a tether of a certain length, LT, and then the membrane tension. So now we add something. We add what Evans left out, the terms he never thought about. We add the Gibbs electromechanical coupling energy. And so what we want to do here is just in the first pass see how sensitive the tether experiment will be to the three major things that might go on. One being a flexoelectric effect, Well, the energy here is the flexoelectric coefficient, the curvature of the electric field. The other being the piezoelectric effect, where you have a piezoelectric coupling coefficient energy, and then the aerial strain, and then, of course, Maxwell forces, okay? And then we just study this at equilibrium by minimizing the potential with respect to the two free parameters, which are the tether radius and tether length, yeah. Okay, yeah. So, So now we consider what we did. What we did first, and then put in physical review last year, was the beautiful case in which I have an aspirated vesicle where all these parameters are well defined because I kind of know the tension on the membrane. Okay, and so what we took is values for the capacitance of the membrane, estimates of the piezoelectric coefficient, and the flexoelectric coefficient. And so what we see here is that in all cases we get this correspondence between the length of the tether. Length of the tether and the tether force, okay? And in the case of Maxwell stresses, we have very small dependence on transmembrane potential. Likewise, in piezoelectricity, we get very small dependence on this slope with the transmembrane potential. But in the case of flexoelectricity, we get real dramatic sensitivity to what changes in the membrane potential. And it's kind of not surprising because the tether experiment, after all, is measuring curvature. So if there's electrically induced change in curvature, we expect that to be where you're sensitive to, as opposed to area dilation. Okay, so now we also model the actual hair cell data that Ibarri has taken, where we do the tether force as a function of potential. And the interesting thing here was that the piezoelectric effect, given the coefficients, direction of coefficients in the hair cell, is actually going in the opposite way of the experimental data. However, the flexoelectric model, when we look at the tether force versus the transmembrane potential, can be fit to the predictions of this theory. And again, the coefficient, the coefficient that comes out here is 10 to the minus 19 coulombs, okay? The same as we had in the whole hair cell model. So now just because your theory fits experimental data, of course, doesn't mean your theory's right. You kind of might be right, but we encourage that things are kind of matching up. Yeah. But people don't quite agree with that. If theory matches experiment, it might be right. Okay, so now I'm going to just say that I've simplified things for the sake of brevity. My first graduate student here, Emily, has actually went through and looked at full thermodynamic type of equations of membrane electromechanics, which you going to defend her thesis next month, and I'm trying to get through it during this meeting, so, but she's got all these, making sure that all her flexo, what I told you was the flexoelectric coefficient is really the flexoelectric coefficient, assuming both alpha and alpha plus minus are a constant. Now she's very careful with the partial derivatives here, and then it's also, it can be distinguished from an electromechanical coefficient, which come about from the differential tension, which is called E amount mobile here. So, but for first pass analysis, okay. Okay, so now what kind of phenomena we expect might come out if the membrane is really electromechanical? One is that it might be sensitive to passive mechanical properties. This is a simplification of the kind of constituent equation for electromechanical membrane. Again, normally the moment result here is just Kc times the curvature. If there's electromechanical, we get the flexoelectric coefficient times the field, also inducing moment. Okay. Now, I had this on the slide. I don't think I mentioned it, but if you add salicylate, which is an active component aspirin, you attenuate the contractions of the outer hair cell membrane. Okay. So some of you may experience if you take too much aspirin, you get tinnitus, which is ringing in your ears, or reversible hearing loss, which is believed to be due to the effect of aspirin on this mechanical contraction of the cell. Okay, so what we wanted to do was go see if aspirin, in fact, changed the mechanical properties of a giant vesicle. So we go to the traditional micropipette aspiration experiment, measure elasticity, bending modulus, and strength. Of course, the thing here, you change the pressure in the pipette, the pressure relates to a tension, length into the pipette gives you an aerial strain, all of which very well geometrically determined. So when you actually do the experiment and you plot your tension versus alpha, of course, you get two regimes here. One regime at very low tensions, which are driven by its the behavior is kind of exponential, and this is driven by a smoothing of the thermal fluctuations. The second regime is a regime of apparent linear elasticity, where it is driven by actual in-plane changes in the elastic modulus. Okay, so kind of get right to the result of the data, which we had last year in the Biophysical Journal, that we have very small changes in the actual elastic compressibility modulus of the membrane as a function of salicylate concentration, but very dramatic changes in the bending stiffness, indicating we believe salicylate is softening up the membrane. And given that it's got a this is molecular structure here, large aromatic group, we expect some changes in the packing of the lipids in the membrane when salicylate is incorporated. But when we think this might further support that the mechanical properties of the membrane are important for the function of Preston. Yes.
So these membranes do contain Preston. These membranes do contain Preston.
Is that not?
Is Preston in these membranes?
No. Preston is not in the membranes. Yeah. That's kind of the next slide. So this is straight mechanics. But if you do alter what's becoming more appreciated, if you start altering the mechanics of the membrane, you affect the function of embedded proteins by altering the level of pressure, especially mechanosensitive proteins like Preston. Okay, so now it's an aside. We also study the failure strength of the membrane, which is another is how it's altered by salicylate. This ended up being it's a little bit complicated parameter because it's a dynamic parameter. The failure strength of the membrane depends on really how fast you're trying to break it, in a sense, so that if you're pulling with a very slow speed, the membrane doesn't appear as strong as if you were change the tension at a very high rate, okay? So once again, this is something Evan Emmons here figured out, and he interpreted this kind of model in terms of a two-step process of membrane rupture. The idea is it begins with a spontaneous defect, okay, which is a small energy barrier to get over the defect. And then as you kind of would increase the size of this cavity, you apply greater tension, you would lead towards kind of an unstable pore, which forms in the membrane. Okay, so what's done experimentally is to look at the tension, lysis tension of the membrane as a function of a loading rate. Okay, so when we do this in control, we get the data that matches Evans, so we know we're on the right track here. When we hit salicylate, we get a change in this kind of low tension regime, which is the energy barrier for cavitation, okay, leading us to the view that what salicylate is doing, there's four parameters that come out of this experiment: the tension scale and the frequency of these defects, and the tension scale and frequency of forming pores in the membrane, and then you can calculate the edge energy of the pore. So we get salicylate not affecting these parameters very much, but greatly dropping the tension scale for forming pores, and then dropping the edge energy along the pore, indicating we think it's kind of a packing, stabilizing pores. Now, I have a colleague who's a gastrointestinal physiologist who loves this because he's been saying for about 20 years that the mechanism by which aspirin causes ulcers is due to changes in the mechanical properties of the hydrophobic lining of the gastrointestinal tract, as opposed to by the prostaglandin. So this idea that you could be stabilizing holes in the membrane with salicylate provides a different mechanism for acid kind of reflux. So we all know to eat a lot of food when we take aspirin. If you don't eat food in your stomach, you'll get this kind of effect going on. So now we wanted to know, because of the GI tract has low pH, whether the salicylate effects are sensitive to pH. So we wanted to do some control experiments, on how pH affects mechanics. And lo and behold, what we kind of notice is something that brings us back to the electromechanical coupling theme, which is that when we look at the bending modulus and the area compressibility modulus over a range of pH values, the elastic compressibility modulus is relatively unchanged over pH. Only at pH 2, we have a very low elasticity. And we attribute that to a phase coexistence, which we've shown by when you have the vesicles and the pipette, they have these kind of half moon shape. And then we use a Lorentz probe, which gives me the generalized polarization. And when there's coexistence, this curve here is flat. Okay? So I don't want to, if anybody wants more on phase transitions, we'll talk later, because I want to get through the electromechanics in the next 5 minutes. So what we notice is that pH 4 and pH 9, we get increases in the kind of bending stiffness. Okay? And not too surprising, because pH 4 is the isoelectric point of the phosphatidylcholine. pH 9 here is the pi of the carboxyl group from the lipid. So we were thinking maybe that somehow the electrostatics of the membrane are altered by pH, and there would be a correspondence. So Jason yesterday talked about the dipole potential, which is a large potential between exterior and interior of the membrane. Comes about through the associated water molecules and dipoles on the lipids. We estimate this by measuring the shift in the excitation spectrum of diene maps, which is a potential sensitive dye. Okay, so when we do this, what we see here is that pH 4 is increasing the dipole potential. pH 9 is evidently decreasing the dipole potential. So now we also have, of course, in the acidic region, we have nice correspondence between the fluorescence ratio and the bending modulus. However, in the basic region, we get the bending stiffness going up and the dipole potential going down. Okay, so we're trying to figure out where that data might mean. So what we did here is the dipole potential measurements have been done by Ronald Clark, okay, for a number of different membranes of a number of different compositions. And then Evans and his postdoc did a measurement of the elasticity of membranes for a number of different composition. So what we did is we put these two things together to form what we call the Clark Kiewicz plot here. And so we notice these kind of three regions, that the polyunsaturated PCs tend to have low bending rigidity and low dipole potential. You saturate it up, the dipole potential goes very high if you saturate the chain. And then in the monounsaturated region, you get kind of a flat behavior where the dipole potential isn't changing, but the bending stiffness continues to go up. Our pH data kind of fall right where they should be for these monounsaturated PCs. So we dissect it further. This is my student broke this up into the chain plot and the saturation plot. So it's again low, and so as you start decreasing in saturation, both KC and dipole potential go up. You start increasing chain length, thickening the bilayer. KC, of course, is going up as the bilayer is thickening, but the dipole potential is going down. And we attribute this to lateral packing in the membrane, basically whenever you're affecting lateral packing, KC and the dipole potential go in the same direction. And you change the thickness, KC and dipole potential kind of go in the opposite direction. Yeah. So our interpretation here is that at pH 4, it's isoelectric point PC, we've kind of excluded ions from the interface, and that alters the packing, okay? Now, on the other hand, with pH 9, which is a peak acid carbonyl, not the carboxyl, the hydroxide ions actually are able to kind of penetrate deeper into the bilayer, we believe disrupting kind of chain, destabilizing this head group area, which is normally held together by cohesive forces. And that leads the lipids to disperse in the direction of the normal and tropically favorable. So it's kind of summary of the pH data. Okay, so now kind of summarize everything I tried to go over in the last hour. Major points here, that cellular membranes certainly manifest electromechanical coupling, especially important in these outer hair cells in the cochlea. Yeah, potentially mediated, as we understand it now, by changes in curvature. Okay? Now, pure membranes are really more definitive measurements, but these subtle changes in composition in terms of where the unsaturation is located on the bond, and electro environment in terms of the pH, which is really not making many too great of a change in the charges, but changing the material properties. Okay? Of course, people say there's nothing new under the sun. Way back in the 1870s, Lippmann, who got the Nobel Prize for physics in 1908, had conducted a mercury voltmeter where he showed that the surface tension of interfaces changes when you change the potential. And in 47, Graham studied this as a function of different ions, which kind of follow the Hofmeister series. So you know this. And so, in a sense, what we've done here is is extended these results to the mechanics of the kind of membrane. If you know more of this literature, I want to know it. Okay. So, and then Fritz Saxon as well has done some AFM experiments where he's got an AFM cantilever on top of a cell. He changes the potential, and he gets this movement of the membrane, and he fits it to the Lippmann equation, describing the coupling between voltage and surface tension. Okay, so then the kind of one of my favorite quotes when I give a talk on this subject. Kelvin said he never satisfies himself until he makes a mechanical model. If he makes a mechanical model, he can understand it. He can't make a mechanical model. That's why he can't get the electromagnetic field. So I think that this coupling of the electromagnetic theory of mechanics is, I think the thing we understand right now better ourselves is the mechanics. Yeah. Okay, so then just acknowledge my students here, one of the students who did all this work, Young did the microaspiration, Emily's the thermodynamics, Jenny and Luis done the optical studies on the question, and then Jeff and Ryan are doing projects I didn't have time to talk about, and then all the people who believed in us over the years. Okay.